Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
In October of 1980, Candy Montgomery sat at a defense table in McKinney and listened to her own lawyer tell the jury she had killed Betty Gore. And then he asked those same jurors to send her home a free woman. What followed was a trial with hypnosis, a buried child memory, and a defense so audacious that reporters in the gallery actually laughed out loud. But some of the jurors didn't think it was so funny. Today, we're wrapping up the case of Betty Gore and the trial of Candy Montgomery. In this last episode, we'll go over the trial, the verdict that made a courtroom erupt, and what happened to everyone left standing once it was over. And most of all, the woman this whole thing happened to, Betty Gore. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are, that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. Crime House exists because of listeners like you. Want even more? Join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of America's Most Infamous Crimes show page. And to help keep growing our community, be sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of extreme violence, the mutilation of a body, and suicide. So please listen with care. This is the third and final episode on Candy Montgomery and the murder of Betty Gore. Today, I'll take you inside the trial, walk through Candy's stunning defense, and tell you what happened to everyone after the verdict that stunned the nation. Candy Montgomery surrendered to police on June 26, 1980, to face a murder charge for killing Betty Gore. The trial started a few months later on October 20th. For 8 days, spectators packed into the courtroom to watch. In fact, there were so many of them that the proceedings were moved out of the county's brand new courthouse and into the old one, just to find enough seats. For some context, this was around the same time the whole country was obsessed with the Who Shot J.R. cliffhanger on the TV show Dallas. And barely an hour up the road, a real-life drama was unfolding that the Dallas Morning News dubbed the ultimate soap opera. In a way, it had all the elements of a soap opera: a church-going housewife, a secret affair, a grisly killing in a quiet town where nothing like this is supposed to happen. For a small Texas community in 1980, this was the biggest thing that had ever happened, and everyone wanted to see how it ended. But underneath the spectacle was something much simpler and much sadder. A young mother was dead, and the woman accused of murder was about to justify why she killed her. So before we dive into the trial itself, let me introduce you to the main players. Presiding over it was Judge Tom Ryan. Leading the prosecution was Collin County District Attorney Tom O'Connell, along with a colleague named Jack Pepper. For the defense, Candy was represented by a lawyer named Don Crowder, and he's worth getting into a little more because he's one of the most fascinating figures to me in the story. Crowder wasn't some hardened criminal defense specialist. In fact, Candy was the first client he would ever represent in a murder trial. He was better known for personal injury work, and he actually knew Candy and Betty personally. All three of them went to the same church, the First United Methodist Church of Lucas. So in all likelihood, the man defending Candy against an axe murder charge had sat in the same pews as the woman she killed. And right out of the gate, Crowder did something almost nobody saw coming. During jury selection, he stood up in front of the 62 prospective jurors and in a few short, flat sentences, told them the one thing you'd expect a defense attorney to spend weeks denying, that Candace Montgomery had killed Betty Gore with an axe. And according to him, it was justified because Candy had acted in self-defense. It was a risky strategy, but it was intentional. Under Texas law, once self-defense is raised, the burden shifts in a very specific way. The prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the killing was not justified. By admitting that Candy swung the axe, Crowder made the prosecution's whole carefully built case, the thumbprint, the bloody footprint, and all the forensics proving Candy did it, almost beside the point. Of course she did it. The only question left for the jury was whether she'd had to. And that was a question the prosecution couldn't answer with physical evidence, because the only living witness to what happened in that room was Candy herself. It fundamentally changed the trial strategy. Tom O'Connell and his team had built a methodical, multi-day case designed to prove that Candy Montgomery killed Betty Gore. Witnesses, forensics, the thumbprint, the timeline, all of it pointed to her. But Don Crowder had already conceded the whole thing before the prosecution said a word. So as O'Connell carefully laid out his defense, a strange feeling settled over the courtroom. The prosecution was working hard to prove a point nobody was arguing about. In a way, they were the opening act for a defense that had quietly seized control of the entire trial. But that didn't mean the prosecution was at a complete disadvantage. Along with the overwhelming evidence, they also had testimony from a forensic pathologist named Vincent DiMaio, and it was chilling. He told the jury that of the 41 axe wounds, Betty Gore's heart had still been beating for 40 of them. Betty was alive for almost the entire attack, although DiMaio believed she was likely unconscious for most of it. But still, 41 blows. It was the number that hung over the entire trial, the thing that the prosecution wanted the jury to never stop thinking about. The prosecution also leaned hard on what Candy did after the killing. Because remember how that day went. Candy calmly showered in the victim's bathroom, drove home, threw her blood-stained clothes in the wash, took Betty's own daughter to a swim lesson and out to a movie, and agreed to host a sleepover, all while a dead body and a crying infant sat in the house she'd left behind. To Tom O'Connell, that wasn't the behavior of a traumatized woman forced to fight for her life. It was the behavior of someone methodically covering her tracks and hoping the body wouldn't be found. And as the prosecution argued, evidence of a guilty mind. But there was also testimony that quietly cut the other way. Betty's husband, Alan Gore, took the stand and testified for nearly 3 hours, walking the jury through the painful details of the affair that had run from late 1978 into the fall of 1979. Here's what's most striking about Alan's testimony. He said that, as far as he knew, Betty and Candy had never argued before, and he told the court he couldn't think of a single reason Candy would have wanted to kill his wife. The prosecution's entire theory rested on the affair as a motive, and the man at the center of that affair was essentially saying he didn't see one. Although I'm not necessarily a fan of Alan Gore and I'm vehemently against cheating, this testimony would be excruciating for almost anyone. Here was a guy whose wife had been violently killed, and he was now forced to sit in front of a packed courtroom and lay out every detail of the affair that had set this tragedy in motion, with the woman who is now on trial for murdering the wife he'd betrayed. Whatever you think of Alan Gore, that is a uniquely awful position to be in, and his answers didn't help the prosecution build its case. If anything, the affair motive theory got weaker the longer he talked. So by the time the prosecution rested, the courtroom was waiting for the only thing that really mattered now. The defense had admitted to the killing. The forensics weren't in dispute. Everything came down to one nearly impossible claim, that hacking a woman 41 times could somehow be self-defense. And there was only one person who could make the jury believe it, Candy Montgomery herself.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around waiting for the track to dry is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at chumbacasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
10 years after Troy, Odysseus is still lost. War hero, liar, survivor, and the man at the heart of one of history's greatest stories. I'm Tristan Hughes, and all of this month on The Ancients, I'm going to be sailing through Homer's treacherous world of monsters, witchcraft, and tempestuous gods, exploring the real archaeology and history beneath the myths. From Troy to Ithaca, this is Odysseus like you've never heard him before. Join us on The Ancients from History Hit. Listen now and subscribe on your favorite podcast player.
Don Crowder knew exactly what his problem was. It was that number, 41. Because self-defense has a built-in limit. The moment the danger is gone, so is the justification. A jury could maybe accept one blow, even a few, in a desperate fight. But 41? How do you explain that and still call it fear? Crowder's answer was the part of this case that made it legendary. Before the trial, he'd arranged for Candy to be examined by a psychiatrist named Dr. Faison. Faison had put Candy under hypnosis, and she'd supposedly accessed an early childhood memory. According to Candy, when she was about 4 years old, she'd lost a foot race to another kid and thrown a tantrum that was so violent, she broke a glass jar and cut herself. While Candy screamed and cried, her mom tried to get her to calm down with a single sharp sound. Shh. You can probably see where this is going. The defense's theory was that when Betty Gore allegedly put a finger to her lips and shushed Candy, that sound released decades of buried rage. Dr. Faison told the jury it had triggered what he called a dissociative reaction, and a second psychiatrist, a doctor named Maurice Green, backed him up on it. He described how Candy was aware that she was hacking Betty to death, but she experienced the whole thing as if it was happening in slow motion, like she was a spectator watching her own hands. Understandably, there was a lot of debate over the validity of the argument, then and now. The jury had to ask themselves if it was really possible for Candy to have entered a dissociative state like that. And there was a real question of whether it was based in real psychology, or as a lot of critics have argued, pseudoscientific junk. But it was a question, and here's a detail that, looking back, may have made all of the difference. At the time, there was a legal standard that would have allowed the prosecution to object and force the defense to prove that hypnosis was a generally accepted, reliable technique. But they didn't. They let it in. And so Dr. Faison's account of Candy's dissociative reaction reached the jury essentially unchallenged. For a defense banking everything on those 41 blows, that was an enormous gift. But not everyone in that courtroom was buying it. When the dissociation testimony came out, some of the reporters in the gallery nudged each other. A few spectators actually laughed. And yet, as the experts talked, multiple jurors were quietly nodding along. Then came the moment everyone had been waiting for. Candy Montgomery took the stand to tell the jury, in her own voice, what had happened. She told them the story we walked through last episode, that Betty had confronted her with the eerily calm question about the affair, then Betty had gone and gotten the axe, and then the two of them had ended up fighting for it. Candy testified that she'd begged her friend to stop, and that Betty, in a voice that sounded far away, had told her, "I've got to kill you." She described running for the utility room door and Betty throwing her body against it to trap her inside, the axe slick with both of their blood. Then she'd put her finger to her lips. Shh. And Candy had snapped. It really was a scene out of a soap opera. This composed, well-liked Sunday school teacher sitting in a witness box, calmly describing one of the most savage killings the county had ever seen, and casting herself, the entire time, as the terrified one fighting to survive. She also admitted to the things that came after, that she'd showered in Betty's bathroom while the baby cried upstairs, then gone home, changed her clothes, and carried on with her day as if nothing had happened. The jury had to weigh all of it together. The woman who said she'd been fighting for her life, and had also calmly gone to a movie just a few hours later. And remember, there wasn't anyone who could contradict any of the parts that happened behind that closed door. The trial itself had a lot of stops and starts. At one point, it was actually halted so that Candy could be evaluated for competency to stand trial, and it was allowed to continue. Throughout it all, Don Crowder and Judge Ryan had a lot of arguments too. From the very start, Crowder openly accused the judge of being biased against him. He was cited for contempt of court more than once, and at one point, he was even jailed. By the time the two sides reached closing arguments, the atmosphere in the room was tense, to say the least. But the prosecution tried to stay calm. In Tom O'Connell's closing argument, he did what he'd done all along. He pointed at the number. He argued that 41 blows wasn't fear, it wasn't panic, it was rage, and it was murder. Meanwhile, Don Crowder told the jury that the prosecution hadn't refuted his self-defense claim with a single word of evidence, and he went somewhere dark to sell it. He argued that in that moment in the utility room, Betty Gore was the aggressor, describing her as an animal in search of prey. Then it was in the jury's hands. 12 people, 9 women and 3 men. And it took them only 3 hours to make a decision. Not guilty. Candy Montgomery had been acquitted of murdering Betty Gore. As the verdict was read out, Candy sat at the defense table trembling, her hands clenched in her lap, staring straight ahead. But outside the room, the reaction was much more heated. As Candy left the courthouse under guard with her husband Pat at her side, stunned spectators screamed after her, calling her a murderer. Alan Gore shook his head and refused to say anything to the press. One bystander who'd come to watch bitterly remarked that you could be sent to jail for stealing a 5-pound bag of sugar, but apparently you could kill someone and walk away free. And then there was Betty's father, Bob Pomeroy, who had traveled from Kansas to sit through the trial of his daughter's killer. He spoke to reporters with a kind of shattered restraint that's almost harder to hear than rage. He said he wasn't happy with the verdict, but Candy now had to live with what she had done. And then he said the thing that, more than 40 years later, still sits at the very center of this case. We don't know what happened, and we never will know what happened. A woman had admitted in open court to killing her friend, striking her with an axe 41 times, and she walked out of the front door and went home. So what happened to everyone after the trial ended? Candy Montgomery did what a lot of people do when a town has turned against them. She left. She and Pat packed up their 2 kids and moved to Georgia, hoping to disappear into a quieter life away from the headlines and the whispers. But their marriage couldn't survive what they'd been through, and a few years later, Candy and Pat divorced. Candy eventually went back to using her maiden name, Wheeler, returned to school, and in what a lot of people find darkly ironic, became a mental health counselor. As far as anyone knows, she's lived a quiet, ordinary life ever since. As for Alan Gore, his story took a turn that landed hard on Betty's family. He remarried so quickly that, by some accounts, he did it while Candy's trial was still going on. Records show he and his new wife bought a home together away from Wiley in early 1981, just months after the trial ended. That marriage also eventually ended in divorce. Today, by most accounts, Alan is retired and living quietly in Florida, having spent decades out of the spotlight after his testimony helped make this case famous. You can imagine how all of that felt to Betty's parents. Their daughter was dead, and her killer walked free. And now Betty's widower had remarried almost immediately and moved on with his life. For the Pomeroys, it must have felt like the world had simply decided to forget Betty and keep going. And then there's Don Crowder, the lawyer who pulled off what may be one of the most improbable acquittals in Texas history. You might expect a win like that to define a career, and for a while it did. Crowder kept practicing law. He served for years as the city attorney for the nearby town of Allen, Texas. He even tried to run for governor in 1986, although he didn't win. But the years that followed grew darker. In 1997, Crowder's brother died in a tragic accident, and he never fully recovered from that loss. His mental health declined, and he struggled with alcohol and drug abuse. On his 56th birthday in 1998, he attempted to take his own life and survived. And in the days afterward, he reportedly expressed remorse to a local paper for his role in the Candy Montgomery trial. Just a few weeks after that, Don Crowder died by suicide. It's a haunting end. The man who stood in the courtroom and convinced 12 jurors to set Candy Montgomery free never made his own peace with it. But the people I keep coming back to in all of this are the two who had the least to say in any of it. Betty's daughter, Elisa, who was 5 years old when her mother was killed, and Bethany, who wasn't even one. After everything, the murder, the trial, their father's quick remarriage, those two little girls weren't raised by Alan. They were raised by Betty's parents back in Kansas. And here's the detail that I think says everything about whose story this really is. Those girls grew up. They built lives. Elisa goes by Lisa now, and she's gone on to a successful career at a major company. And Bethany, the baby at the center of the most horrifying part of this whole case, she grew up to become a teacher, just like her mother. By the accounts that are public, both daughters eventually reconnected with their father, and both have families of their own now. The two little girls whose mother was taken from them on a Friday afternoon are grown women who built full, ordinary lives. The kinds of lives Betty wanted for them and didn't get to see. In the decades since, the case has never really let go of the public imagination. Back in 1984, the journalists Jim Atkinson and John Bloom wrote a detailed two-part account for Texas Monthly called Love and Death in Silicon Prairie. They also turned their reporting into a definitive book on the case, Evidence of Love, which was a major source we used for the series. And decades after that, Hollywood came calling twice in the span of a single year. In 2022, Hulu released a series called Candy, with Jessica Biel in the title role and Melanie Lynskey as Betty. The very next year, HBO released Love and Death with Elizabeth Olsen as Candy, Jesse Plemons as Alan, and Lily Rabe as Betty. Two major productions, a parade of famous actresses, all of them stepping into the role of Candy Montgomery. And that's the part that I want to talk about as we close this out, because notice whose name is in the titles. Notice whose face is on the posters. The story that the world remembers is Candy's story. The killer became the main character, and Betty Gore, the wife, the mother, the fifth grade teacher, became a supporting role in the story of her own death. So let me end where I think this should end. The honest truth is that we will never know what happened in that utility room on June 13th, 1980. Only two people were there, and only one of them came out, and she's the one who got to tell us. The jury reached its verdict, and Betty's own father admitted that the rest of us are left with a question that can't be answered. That's the hard, unsatisfying reality of this case. But here's what we do know. We know Betty. We know she was a young woman from Kansas who wanted more than anything to be a teacher and to take care of people. We know she was a mother of two who fought a quiet, lonely battle with her own mind that almost nobody around her fully understood. We know she should have grown old. Her father once said she should be a grandmother by now. Instead, her parents buried her and raised her children. So whatever you believe about Candy Montgomery, I want to leave you with the name that too often gets lost in this story. Not the woman who walked free, the woman who didn't, Betty Gore. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts. So make sure to comment below.
Let's start with the big one. Do you think the jury got it right?
This is a hard one, and I don't know if everyone will like my answer. Do I think Candy was guilty? Yes. But even for me, there is a shred of doubt. 41 strikes with an axe goes far beyond self-defense. The fact that she left the house and carried on with her day without any concern for what would happen to baby Bethany is insane, especially because she even said she didn't think anyone would find the body that soon. So she was just going to let her cry, starve, and soil herself and potentially die. She didn't report the self-defense right away. She didn't even report it when the police called her in. It wasn't until she met with her lawyers that she had this tidy self-defense story and a hypnotist saying that the overkill was triggered by a shh sound. It's a lot. But the fact that the murder weapon was Betty's own axe in Betty's own home is where the doubt comes in. The defense was able to tell a plausible story. A woman suffering from postpartum depression, something that can change who a woman is and what she is capable of. It could be plausible that Candy had seen the axe previously and grabbed it, but if she didn't bring a weapon, that cuts away at premeditation. Could Betty really have just broke with the mounting pressures of a newborn, a five-year-old, and a cheating husband who is constantly on business trips, leaving her completely alone to take care of the kids? we will never know what really happened, so it's hard to cut anything out entirely. It does leave us with a real defensible version of events where two women ended up in a horrifying struggle and only one survived. But again, I can't get past that number. 41. 40 wounds while she was still alive. Self-defense ends when the threat ends. And somewhere in those 41 blows, the threat very clearly ended and the swinging didn't. So where I actually land is closer to where Betty's father landed. I don't know if the prosecution proved murder beyond a reasonable doubt. But not proven and innocent are not the same thing. And I understand completely why that town heard not guilty and screamed.
The hypnosis defense, the buried memory, the shh, the dissociative reaction. Be honest with me. Do you buy it?
As a legal strategy, it's brilliant. As actual science, though, I'm deeply skeptical, and so are a lot of experts who've looked at it since. The thing you have to understand is what that testimony accomplished. The number 41 was the wall the defense could not get over, until Faison gave the jury a way to split the killing into two parts. The first blows are self-defense. Everything after is a woman who's psychologically not there. Suddenly, the jurors don't have to choose between believing Candy and being horrified by the violence. They get to do both. That's the genius of it. But memory recovered under hypnosis is notoriously unreliable. Hypnosis can produce vivid, sincere, completely manufactured memories. And the idea that a childhood shushing detonates into 41 axe blows decades later is, to put it gently, not exactly settled psychiatry. What really gets me is that the prosecution never even challenged whether that testimony should be allowed in. They could have, but they didn't. And so the jury heard it as basically uncontested expert fact.
Alan may have remarried while the trial was still happening. How do you read that?
Oof. I try really hard on the show not to be the judge of people's private grief because everyone mourns differently and there's no correct timeline. But seriously, that man needed to have some shame. It doesn't surprise me in the least. He is obviously a very selfish person. But at least for the sake of your daughters and the family of your wife who you supposedly loved, hold off. Being in a whole relationship in and of itself is too fast, but actually getting married during the trial is insane. I completely understand why Betty's family saw it as a kind of final insult. And honestly, it sharpens one of the quietest tragedies in this whole case, which is that Alan does not end up raising his own daughters. Betty's parents do. And so you have this man at the absolute center of the affair that set everything in motion. And when the dust settles, he moves on, remarries, moves away, and Betty's mom and dad are the ones in Kansas raising the two little girls Betty left behind.
45 years later, what's the thing about this case that stays with you?
There are a few things. First is just the frustration with the whole situation and the fact that this happens over and over again to this day. Like, please, can people just stop cheating and killing people? Because I'm tired of it. But more than that is the loss, especially for their two baby girls. Bethany was left all alone in her crib for the entire day, one floor above the worst thing imaginable, and potentially left for dead as well. Both her and her sister lose their mom in this tragic way, and then their dad runs off during the trial for the person who killed their mother, the time where these two girls needed the most love and support. He goes and gets married. But luckily, Betty's parents stepped up and raised them, and both girls ended up becoming successful and having families of their own. Bethany even grew up to become a teacher, the exact thing her mother dreamed of being since she was a little girl taking care of her brothers. There's something almost unbearably poignant in that. Betty Gore wanted to spend her life teaching children and taking care of people, and she had that taken away from her on a Friday afternoon in her own laundry room. And the daughter she never got to raise carried that dream forward anyways, without her. That's the thing I can't shake. Not the axe, not the trial, not the verdict. That. Thanks so much for joining me for this series on Candy Montgomery and the killing of Betty Gore. Come back next week for another deep dive into a true crime that changed America. And to enhance your listening experience, join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Story dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com. Or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of America's Most Infamous Crime show page. Thank you. everyone, it's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.